Call the meeting of the Joint House Senate Subcommittee on Claims to order. We're a little short of a quorum, so we're going to skip over the minutes approval for now. But we are going to go ahead and dive right into the main portion and purpose of this meeting, which was to welcome and hear from the special master panel of the 35W Bridge Compensation Scheme. And how it went, and I know you've got a presentation prepared, so Susan Holden, chair of the panel, welcome. Stephen Kirsch and Mike Tewksbury, appreciate your being here and taking the time to let us know. As I've told you already, there are a lot of competing meetings going on at the legislature this time of year, and people will be hopefully dropping in and out as their schedule permits during the presentation. I want to especially recognize Representative Dennis Osman, who no longer serves after many years of dedicated service in the legislature. He was the co-chair of the House Senate Subcommittee on Claims at the time that we first initiated hearings about a month after the collapse of the 35W Bridge. And this will bring the process full circle in terms of the committee's work, and especially want to recognize his work and his service in this particular context. Welcome back, Dennis.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Should we go around real quickly and just have each member introduce themselves before we get started with the formal presentation?
Well, I'm State Representative Diane Loeffler. I represent Northeast Minneapolis, just at the north end of the bridge, so it had a big impact on my district as well as several constituents. But I'm also was a member of the Claims Committee when we, with very thoughtful deliberation, tried to figure out the best process. And I'm going to have to run off to a Rules Committee meeting, but I just want to take this opportunity to say thank you for stepping up to what I'm sure was an absolutely fascinating but also very difficult and challenging job. On behalf of my constituents, I'd just like to say thank you so much.
I'm State Representative Bruce Anderson, and on the day that the bridge collapsed, I was on active duty in Japan and was quite surprised to hear all about this, and I'm glad that you stepped up to the challenge of doing this panel, and I look forward to what you have to present to us.
I'm Craig Lindeke. I'm subcommittee counsel from the Revisor of Statutes Office.
And I'm Lyle Kuhn, and I represent District 20B in west central Minnesota, which includes Chippewa County, Renville County, Yellow Medicine County. And I want to say thank you to all three of you for stepping up to do this work, and looking forward to hear what you have to say today. Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't we go ahead and let's introduce the staff also that also worked through this process. Go ahead, just introduce yourselves, if you would.
Cheryl Joachim, I'm the legislative aide for Senator Latz.
And I'm Diane Henry Wangenstein. I'm the staff support for the Subcommittee on Claims.
And my intern? Go ahead.
I'm Libby Kantner. I'm Senator Latz's intern.
Thank you. I want to recognize Peter Watson, who's here. Peter, you're welcome to come on up to the table with us, please. Peter was also very instrumental in helping to formulate the legal structure and the compensation scheme that ultimately got passed by the legislature. Wears a couple of hats now in the Senate besides being chief counsel. But welcome to our committee. We're awfully glad to have you here. Ms. Holden, why don't you go ahead and start the presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you know, my name is Susan Holden, and I chaired the Special Master panel, and I'm here today with my two colleagues, Mike Tewksbury and Steve Kirsch. We are lawyers in private practice here in the Twin Cities. I practice at the law firm of Stephen Gross and Von Holtum in Minneapolis. Mike is in firm of Tewksbury and Kerfeld in Minneapolis, and Mr. Kirsch is in the Murnan law firm here in St. Paul. And the three of us were appointed on May 29th, 2008, by then Chief Justice Russell Anderson to serve on this panel that your committee helped design. The role of the special masters in this process was to consider claims, make settlement offers, and enter settlement agreements with the survivors, and to design a claims process that would allow us to perform those duties within the deadlines of the statute that was passed. This compensation process was restricted only for the benefit of survivors of the bridge collapse, and the law authorizing this process was very specific about who a survivor was. The survivors included a natural person who was on the bridge at the time that it collapsed, or a survivor could also include a person, the family members of a person who died in the collapse, or a legally recognized representative of a survivor, someone who was on the bridge. Those legally recognized representatives would include a parent or guardian of a minor who was on the bridge, or a court-appointed trustee who is authorized under Minnesota's wrongful death laws to bring the claims on behalf of the surviving family members of someone who perished in the collapse. So when we talk about a survivor today, it's that statutory definition of survivor that we are referring to. We started immediately after our appointment considering what this process should be and studying the legislation that was passed to make sure that we stayed true to what was apparently intended by all of you in passing this law. We designed a batch of forms that eventually became available on a website, and the forms were standardized claim forms that would allow survivors to submit their claims for various types of damages, for personal injury claim, a property damage claim, or a wrongful death claim. And those forms included a list of all the documents that a survivor would need to submit in support of their claim as well. They required a variety of disclosures. In the personal injury context, for example, people needed to describe whether or not they'd been injured in other ways in the past so that we'd have adequate information on which to assess what injury was caused in the collapse and a fair evaluation of those injuries. We also developed settlement agreement and release forms in consultation with the Attorney General's office so that people would know ahead of time that if they accepted compensation from this special compensation process, that they would have to release their claims against the state of Minnesota or any municipality or employee of those governmental units. Early in the process, we convened what we called joint meetings. We needed the input of the Attorney General's office related to the release forms. We wanted input and wanted to build consensus among the lawyers who were representing survivors. And so we convened meetings with a few of the lawyers who represented survivors, as well as representatives from the Attorney General's office. And we talked through what we envisioned the process would be, got their input, refined a process that met the deadlines, and gained their confidence in the process. And it was also, I think, very helpful for us as the panel and for the Attorney General's office in considering various legal issues surrounding the releases. And so we convened several of those meetings that were very helpful and instrumental in allowing us to get the process ready for the survivors in a timely manner. Our goal was to have this process ready for a survivor to submit their claim to us before the anniversary of the bridge collapse. So before August 1st of 2008, a few weeks after we were appointed, we wanted to have the process ready. We wanted also to have to allow access to accurate information and to the claim forms 24/7. And the only way that we could do that was to design a website that people could access through the internet, get answers to frequently asked questions, read about an overview of the process, access the claim forms themselves, read the sample of the release form, and basically have accurate information that they needed to submit their claims. That website is still up and running if you'd like to look at it. We had hoped to display it here for you today, but due to technical difficulty, we're not able to do that.
Beyond our control.
It is bridgecollapseclaims.com, or you can get there, .net.org. Just type in bridgecollapseclaims.com, and it will take you right to our website. and all the information and background materials that were available to survivors. It also proved to be helpful for the press and other people who were interested and had questions about our process. The lawyers that were representing the survivors could access links to the statute through a description of the process, and the frequently asked questions covered virtually every subdivision of the statute that was passed, so that lawyers, if they had questions about the process and how it related to a particular provision within the law, could access that information on the website. That process and the website was launched July 28th, a few days before the anniversary of the bridge collapse. The statute set out a very strict claim submission deadline. October 15th, 2008 was the deadline under the law for claims to be submitted. Any claims submitted after that point in time, this panel would not have considered. Fortunately, that deadline was well publicized. It was on the website, and we talked about it every chance that we got within the media and in meetings with lawyers representing the survivors. We did not receive any late submissions. Everyone who participated in this process submitted their claim by October 15th, 2008, and we received 179 claims. The claim applications that were due by that date consisted of a general information form that identified the survivor and their lawyer and gave us some input as to the type of meeting that they wanted to have with the special master panel. We found out in those joint meetings that even though the statute said that at least one member of the panel should meet with each survivor, that there were some survivors who may not wish to exercise that right and meet with us. And we also knew that there were claims that we wanted to hear as a group, as the full panel meeting with survivors, particularly in the death claims and some of the more seriously injured. So we gave people an option in their claim application to tell us what type of meeting they would like with survivors. 100 people selected the meeting with a single member of the special master panel, and we divided those 100 cases among the three of us, and we each scheduled those in our own offices and met. But even though only one member of the panel met with the survivor, each of us read complete written submissions, and each week we deliberated all of those cases, reaching together a consensus on the damage determinations and the various calculations we needed to make for settlement offers under the statute. There were 70 survivors who selected full panel meetings, and we did those each week as well. We met one or two days a week as a full panel and completed those full panel hearings. And then used those days, if there was time, to deliberate other cases that the three of us had heard individually the week before. I talked a little bit about the applicable damages information forms. There were three types, personal injury, wrongful death, or property damage. And survivors could submit more than one claim. For example, if they had a personal injury claim, they may also submit a property damage claim. Or if they had a wrongful death claim, they could also, if appropriate, submit a property damage claim. The other important form that was a part of the claim application was the damages adjustment form. You may recall from the statute that the offer of settlement calculation is derived from the panel determining overall what the total damages of an individual is for their personal injury claim, property damage claim, what that total is. We were allowed to consider under this law any appropriate element of damage that could otherwise be claimed under Minnesota's tort law, or in a personal injury claim, or in a normal wrongful death claim. And so our initial damages determinations were to look at each element of claimed damages and assign some preliminary valuation to that to arrive at a total damages number, and from that then deduct in order to reach a potential offer of settlement calculation to deduct from that benefits that had been paid from a health plan, workers' compensation, disability insurance, any kind of benefit plan that had already paid. This fund was designed not to duplicate those benefits. And so the offers of settlement that resulted did not repay benefits that insurers had otherwise paid. And so there was a damages adjustment form that required survivors to submit to us all of the benefits that they had been paid for damages that they were claiming, so that the panel could make accurate calculations of the potential settlement offer under that subdivision of the statute. There was also, finally, a verification form that the lawyer and the survivor would sign, verifying or attesting to the accuracy of the information that they provided the panel. In the event that a spouse of a survivor who had, under Minnesota's law, a consortium claim, they too had to sign the verification form. So it was that packet of forms that made up each claim file. But in support of their claim, survivors were invited to submit to us any documentation that they felt would be helpful to the panel in accurately evaluating their damages. If they asserted a claim for future medical expenses, for example, we wanted to see a medical expert's opinion about the need for future medical care and what that might cost. For loss of earnings or earning capacity claims that would extend into the future, likewise, we wanted to see, and many submitted, opinions of economic experts that would calculate what that loss of earnings was projected into the future and reduced to present value. There were expert reports from vocational rehabilitation specialists, counselors, trained in the area of rehabilitating people and getting them back into gainful employment in an area that they were physically capable of and had the aptitude to perform. We saw many of those reports for many of the seriously injured people about their ability to work and what their injuries meant to them long term in terms of their ability to earn a living. Once the application deadline passed on October 15th, 2008, we immediately began the meetings or hearings with survivors. Those hearings were scheduled through the end of January, and we were unsure whether or not there would be enough money in the appropriation to fully compensate the survivors for the settlement offers that we calculated. And so we did not make any settlement offers until we had heard all of the cases and could figure out whether or not there was enough money. And in the event, as it turned out, there was not, then we needed to make a fair distribution of those proceeds by further reducing offers. And Mr. Tewksbury will talk a little bit in a few minutes about those reductions that we made. The meetings themselves were an important part of the process. All of you foresaw in passing this law, I think, by requiring that at least one member of the panel meet with each survivor, you foresaw the importance of that step in the process to the survivors. The ability for them to tell their story and feel like they were heard was an important element, and we wanted those meetings to be as comfortable for them so that they could present to us what they felt was important so that we could better understand how this bridge collapse had affected them and changed their lives. So the meetings were not held in courtrooms. They were held in conference rooms where we talked across the table. And they weren't sworn under oath. They were not cross-examined. There was no defense counsel for the state. We simply requested the information that a defense lawyer would want to see in evaluating a claim. We asked for supplemental documentation when we needed it on particular elements of damages. But those meetings were times for the lawyers and survivors to present to us what they felt was important about their injury claim and to tell us what they'd been through and to tell us what medical treatment they had received and what they needed in the future and how their injuries were affecting them. We appeared at each of these meetings or hearings with survivors, having already read all of the background material in their claim application that they had submitted to us. So we had a number of questions for them, but those meetings started out with them telling us what they felt was important. And the feedback that we have gotten is that most survivors felt very comfortable in those meetings. They were difficult discussions to have because they were so personal. I think they all left feeling like we had listened carefully to them and cared about what happened to them.
Ms. Holden, before you go on, I want to recognize Representative Simon, who is also in the Legislative Audit Commission. And he's got a competing meeting, but Representative Simon was a conferee as we put the final package together. I want to recognize his attendance here today, too.
And I just want to say thank you, Senator Latz. I appreciate it, and I want to thank this committee. I used to be on this committee in my first term, but I think all of you on this committee really laid the groundwork for the finished product, and obviously, Senator Latz, you were one of the godfathers of the bill, and so I think you deserve tremendous credit for getting this enacted into law. I know it was a very long, rough process, but I think we're seeing here the results, and so congratulations to you and to this committee for its deliberations and hard work. Unfortunately, we have a House floor session, actually, so I have to leave a little bit early. And I want to thank all of you. I've had a chance to thank you before at another hearing that we had over in the Capitol building, but thanks again for your great service that you and the many hours that you've contributed to making this work. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
While we're going along, if anyone at the table has any questions, by all means, I'm sure Ms. Holden won't mind the interruption.
Absolutely. That would be fine. We'd be happy to answer any questions that you have as we go along, and certainly when our comments are concluded, I'm sure that you'll have a number of questions we'd be happy to answer as well. This process took several months, and we requested that survivors submit as much of their documentation by the October 15th deadline. But we were still doing hearings in January, and people were still receiving medical treatment. Their damages were still mounting. And in some respects, their future and what it looked like was a work in progress. And so we did allow survivors to supplement the information in their claims packets through the middle of January, so that by the time that we completed all of the hearings by January 30th, we had up-to-date information, including not just their claims of damages, but also the damages adjustment information that we needed to deduct from the total damages calculation to arrive at a possible settlement offer. Once we reached the end of those hearings, we reviewed all of those supplemental materials and went back through every case and every preliminary damages determination. We completed further calculations based on the updated information. And you may recall the two appropriations for this totaled $36.64 million. The first $24 million was what we called the general compensation fund, and that was there to compensate any type of damage that could be claimed under Minnesota's tort laws, but this fund was capped so that no individual could recover more than $400,000. The remaining $12.64 million was for supplemental payments, and those were specifically indicated in the statute to pay only uncompensated medical expenses or lost earnings or financial support. Those funds could not be used to compensate a survivor for pain, suffering, disability, emotional distress, or the more intangible elements of loss that surely go along with the personal injuries that were suffered. The deadline for the panel to make settlement offers out of those funds was February 28th of this year, and we met that deadline. Each survivor who presented a claim received an offer of settlement. We did have a process in the, or a section of the claim form application that required that they submit to us verification that they were actually eligible. And that meant, you know, were they on the bridge or was their family member on the bridge when it collapsed? We did not receive any claim submission that could not be verified as an eligible survivor. We did have a process arranged with the Attorney General's office in the case that we did. And any claim that we could not verify or weren't satisfied was a verified eligible survivor was referred to the Attorney General's office for further investigation. We didn't have to employ that process. I'm pleased to report. When we refined our calculations in February after reviewing the supplemental submissions by the survivors, we reached our final total damages calculations, and those 179 claims, the total damages sum was over $99 million. So there were some reductions that we needed to make so that our preliminary offer calculations or the offers that eventually went to the survivors would fit within the appropriation. That $99 million in total damages is not the total amount of possible settlement offers. Remember that we had to deduct from that those total damages calculations the collateral sources or the benefits that had been paid by health insurers and other benefit plans. But we were,
Holden, as I recall, that each person's total damages amount was also is also still important because it will have an impact on when and how the state can seek subrogation interest from any third party payments to those parties. Is that
that's correct? And that's why the panel spent quite a bit of time refining those total damages calculations, because it is an important trigger in the statute. The survivor, we informed each survivor in their settlement packet that included their offer, we informed them of the total damages figure that we calculated, because that triggers their obligation if they pursue additional claims against bridge contractors or inspectors, entities that have not been released, the state or municipality who are released in this process. If they recover those total damages or in excess of those total damages, then they must notify the state of Minnesota and the state can be reimbursed or exercise their subrogation right that was a part of this bridge statute. So the total damages number was important for that respect, and also as a starting point for us to start reducing the collateral sources to arrive at a possible settlement offer.
In this way, the state became the first payer, but sort of the last resort in terms of making sure that the survivors got some payment. So if, for example, the contractor on the bridge were to end up compensating, and the person got more than their total damage. Let's say the total damages amount was $1 million and they got $600,000 from the panel. If they got more than the $1 million figure, then the state would be able to recover part of what we paid out to the survivor. I suppose that could then become subject to litigation or negotiations between the state and that third-party payer as to who was more responsible. Also, ultimately, there could be some battle going on there. So the state was sort of the guarantor of some compensation for eligible survivors, but not the first resort in the end.
Right. It turned out that after we performed all of the deductions in the offer of settlement calculation formula in the statute, and after we applied the $400,000 cap to the general compensation fund, we were, our calculations of possible offers still exceeded the appropriation by $9.7 million. That consisted of $4.4 million in the capped fund and $5.3 million for the supplemental payments fund. So we had to reduce the offers from those funds by $9.7 million in order to fit the appropriation.
So could you explain that a little more detail, Ms. Holden?
Sure. The the statute had a provision in it that told us how to arrive at the settlement offer calculation. And it was to calculate the total damages and then reduce that by any benefits that had been paid from various sources that were specified in the statute, such as the emergency funds that were immediately available or more immediately available to the survivors for wage loss and things of that nature. It also included collateral sources. We have a statute in Minnesota that defines what those collateral sources are, but no-fault benefits from car insurance for medical and wage loss, health insurance benefits that pay medical expenses, disability coverages or plans that employers provide that supplement with people's income when they were missing time from work, workers' compensation benefits. Those kinds of things had to be deducted from our damages figures so that the offers that we sent to survivors did not duplicate those benefits, that they weren't also getting them from their car insurer and also getting them paid from the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota.
So after you deducted all of those, you still had claims that would have been compensable out of our funds, more $9.7 million more for the first fund?
No, total. For the first fund, we were $4.4 million over in the first fund after we made the deductions and applied the cap. So we had to look at the claim.
Would that have included then calculations for pain and suffering, emotional distress?
It did.
Okay.
It did. It included all of the elements of damages that could be claimed under Minnesota's tort law, and that was pain, suffering, disability, emotional distress, and aid, comfort, and guidance, and a wrongful death claim. So not just the hard economic losses that we think of in terms of medical expenses or loss of income, or in a death case, the projected loss of income over the lifetime of the decedent and their surviving family members, but it included those intangible losses that are properly claimed under Minnesota's law for pain, suffering, and in the case of a death case, loss of companionship, guidance, and comfort.
And then how did you determine that certain claimants were eligible for compensation out of the second fund?
The statute was very specific in giving us guidance in that regard. The supplemental payments were only to pay medical expenses, uncompensated medical expenses, or uncompensated loss of earnings or financial support. And it had to be lost by a survivor whose damages exceeded the $400,000 cap in the first fund. So if we found someone's total possible offer calculation was less than $400,000, they were not eligible for the supplemental payment fund. That was spelled out specifically in the statute. On the other hand, if their possible offer of settlement from the calculation in the statute exceeded $400,000, then they were eligible for the supplemental payments fund, but only if they had the right kind of damages. It had to be uncompensated medical or uncompensated loss of earnings or financial support. And so that's how we figured out who was actually eligible for those supplemental payments. The statute was a very specific guide for us in that regard.
For those claimants, toward what damages did the first fund contribute then? How was that handled?
Well, I guess you could view the first fund as setting a cap on the intangible loss, that no one would ever recover, no matter how great their disability or how great their loss, they would never recover more than $400,000 for pain, suffering, and disability. Most people who received or were eligible to receive up to that capped amount had a combination of pain and suffering damages, but also economic losses. And so those elements of economic loss that exceeded the $400,000 amount were then compensated out of the supplemental payments fund.
So their medical expenses or loss of wages did not themselves need to exceed the $400,000?
Right.
Okay.
It was the total of all of their damages. It was actually the total of the offer of settlement calculation under Subdivision 10 of the statute. And because we needed to reduce the offers in the from that first $24 million fund by $4.4 million, there were a number of people that would have been eligible to receive the full cap, but we couldn't pay them the full cap amount of $400,000 because there wasn't enough money to go around. And Mike Tewksbury will talk to you a little bit about what some of the how we arrived at. Yeah, the process that we use to arrive at those deductions. The offers of settlement went out by the end of February as the deadline required in the statute. The offers included the amount from both of these appropriations. They were told what their total settlement offer was and how much of that was a supplemental payment. And if there was no supplemental payment, they were informed that they were not eligible under the law for a supplemental payment. The offer also included a notice of the state's right to be reimbursed or subrogation, the right that we talked about earlier. And in that notice, we informed them of the panel's calculation of their total damages, which triggered their obligation under the statute to notify the state should they pursue further claims and recover more than the total damages figure. The statute indicated that survivors had 45 days in which to accept or reject the settlement offer. The deadline for the last acceptance to come in was April 16th, 2009, and every one of the 179 claims submitted accepted the settlement offers of the panel. We did have a process in place in the event that someone either rejected their settlement offer or their offer was rescinded by operation of the statute. The deadline of 45 days was not something the panel could extend. That was a decision that was made here at the legislature and was a part of the law. And if people were late or couldn't make a decision within that time frame, their offer was rescinded automatically under the law, and the panel prepared a process in which we would redistribute funds that were either rejected or rescinded by operation of the statute and redistribute those funds to other survivors who had accepted settlement offers but who still had uncompensated losses that fit within the appropriation restrictions of the general compensation fund and the supplemental payments. Because everyone accepted their offers and accepted within the deadline, we did not have to employ that redistribution process. And again, we were pleased with that, that we didn't have to redistribute funds to other people, or that we had survivors who were so unhappy with their offers that they would not accept them. That didn't happen. And now we have been paying claims over the course of several weeks. Dennis Munkowitz, who is the state's chief financial officer, is here today. We had a standing meeting with Dennis. He signed all of the settlement agreements and release forms as the state's representative. And in the cases where there were structured settlements, he also signed a document called a Uniform Qualified Assignment. And every week we brought settlement files to his office, and he signed them, and we matched them up with settlement checks and checked and double-checked, and each week dispersed settlement amounts to survivors as the agreements dictated. We have paid 178 of 179 claims. So we're very nearly done. There is one death case that is out there that is subject to the court approval on the final distribution. And a hearing was held last week, and that matter is under advisement. As soon as we have a court order authorizing the distribution to the particular parties who have a claim in that death case, we will be able to disperse that, and the final settlement will be paid.
That's typically done in a minor settlement, is that right?
Yes. There, minor settlements are required to be approved. The actual settlement itself be approved by a judge of the district court, and the deposit or the disbursement of the funds must also be court approved. And so we did develop a process that would allow survivors to get that court approval done within the 45-day acceptance period. That is particularly critical with respect to minor settlements because the court has to say, yes, you're authorized to accept the settlement. So we had great cooperation with every state agency or division that we needed to work with to ensure that this process worked swiftly and efficiently and served the needs of the survivors and got the job done within the deadlines. State Court Administration collaborated with us in working with the chief judges in Hennepin and Ramsey County to set up an expedited filing process for approval of the minor settlements and the death cases that came out of the bridge collapse. There were 55 minor settlements, and they set aside hearing time and assigned specific judges in each of Hennepin and Ramsey County to get a minor settlement approved in this process. They did not have to pay a filing fee. The panel divided the minor settlements between Hennepin and Ramsey County and pre-assigned them, and the lawyers representing the minors called ahead and had reserved time on the judge's calendar. Before they even knew what the settlement offer was going to be, they had time reserved with a judge so they knew they could get their court approvals done within the 45-day time frame. So,
was there one judge in each of the counties that handled all of them, or was it distributed throughout the bench or both hearing civil calendars?
In Hennepin County, there were two judges responsible for that. It was Judge Gary Larson and Judge Lloyd Zimmerman. In Ramsey County, they handled it a little differently. All the judges, and they had probably a half a dozen judges assigned in their civil division, and any one of those judges could be asked to do an approval hearing. And there was a point person in court administration, the deputy administrator, who made sure that any call for a survivor in the bridge collapse had hearing time scheduled within the 45-day time frame. And they used a variety of judges, but at least a half a dozen different judges. I would like to recognize the work of the lawyers that represented survivors in this process. Some of you may have met Chris Messerly of the Robbins Kaplan firm and his colleague Phil Seif. They and many lawyers from the Minnesota Association of Justice formed a pro bono consortium where lawyers skilled in representing injured people and representing family members who have wrongful death claims donated their time, worked free of charge on a pro bono basis to represent survivors through this special compensation process. Their job and the work that they performed made our jobs much easier. We are better able to make quality decisions about the damages in every case because those lawyers had prepared the documentation necessary, and they knew what documentation it was that we needed. They retained the appropriate experts, the vocational experts, the economic experts. They requested the right written opinions from the medical doctors and surgeons that worked on the survivors and were treating them, and provided us with the necessary information so that we could make good decisions, fair decisions on behalf of the survivors. And so those lawyers deserve a great deal of thanks, and we certainly commend the work that they did.
Ms. Holden, how many of the claimants were represented by attorneys, do you know?
Most. There were very few that were not represented. A dozen, maybe, that were not represented. Everyone else had a lawyer, and we encouraged many survivors. Before the deadline for claim submission, the panel received emails through our websites and phone calls from survivors, people that weren't sure if they should submit a claim or how to submit a claim or whether they needed a lawyer to submit a claim. And we made sure that everyone knew they didn't have to have a lawyer, but we encouraged everyone to retain a lawyer. There was a list of the lawyers on the website who were representing clients on a pro bono basis, and we encouraged the survivors to talk to any one of the lawyers that they wanted to get representation. Because they were not going to be charged for the lawyer's representation, it just made sense that they'd have good legal advice about how to best present the damages claim unique to them. So most everyone was able to retain a lawyer and be represented through the process. I guess now would be a good time to turn over to my colleagues. Steve Kirsch will address some of the factors and things that we considered in evaluating the claims, and then Mike Tewksbury will talk about some of the reductions we made in order to fit the appropriations.
Thank you. My name is Steve Kirsch. I'm with Bernan Brandt in St. Paul. The hearings that we all went through, approximately 100, each of us, 70 together, were very emotional. And we followed Minnesota law in the jury instructions that a jury would be given. And one of the instructions is you don't let sympathy interfere with your deliberations. Now, the advantage that we had was it was not an adversarial process. As Sue said, not only was there no cross-examination, we were as kind and gentle as we could humanly be possible because we weren't there to attack them at all. We were there to make their make this as comfortable as we could. We even went through the trouble of meeting, or through the video, we spent 2 hours with a post-traumatic stress disorder expert witness because we didn't want to make some of these people who had psychological injuries worse by asking questions about the bridge. And we all learned a lot about post-traumatic. A majority of these people had legitimate psychological issues, and when you look at the pictures and you hear the stories, it's not difficult to understand why they had these problems. So what we had to do is we had to serve as a three-person jury and also a three-panel judicial appellate and a three-person judge grouping. We did it all because we had to figure out, we have this money, how are we going to give it out? And after we did the claims and after we came up with the process, we felt one of the most important things is the evaluation of witnesses, and that's why the hearings were important. Let these people say what was on their mind. It was just invaluable to us. And yes, we had their medical records. We had medical record summaries. We had vocational reports for those who not only miss work, but were going to miss work in the future. And we need expert guidance on that. We weren't bound by what the expert said, just like a jury wouldn't be bound, just like a judge wouldn't be bound. Most of the expert reports were good. There were a few that were very repetitive, that basically were saying the same thing for every person, so we had to look at those a little with more scrutiny. We understand some of the experts did the reports for free, which again supported this overall process that the victims, the survivors, were actually getting pretty much all their money. You know, no attorney's fees taken out. Even the structured settlement people tried to work out discounting some of their fees as best they could. We had to look at what pre-existing injuries people had. Not that in a typical civil setting, the defense lawyer, if he's defending a case and a person had a bad back 3 years ago and they injure their back in the accident, obviously one of the issues would be, well, what role did the earlier accident play? We didn't have too much of that. I mean, people in the bridge, we had dozens of people that had compression fractures, and those people had not had compression fractures before. We had a couple people that had some psychological issues before the bridge, and that may have been somewhat relevant in looking at their damages. By and large, the pre-existing conditions was not a real major factor. So we had to put all of this information together, and the three of us had a very active discussion on what is this compression fracture worth for a 10-year-old? What is the compression fracture worth for a 40-year-old? How is this person's post-traumatic stress affecting their life? How is this 10-year-old's post-traumatic? And we went through and spent an enormous amount of time on each case, came through our process in evaluating, here's the number for a death case, here's the number for a personal injury case. And after we got through, as Sue had mentioned, the subrogation issues and the waivers and the what's going to be set off, and Mike will talk about that, we had a good feel for what each person would get. The problem was, the most excruciating part of it was the continual cuts that Mike will talk about, because that was really difficult for us. We had to, you gave us a budget. And the way that this was set up really helped us, because the guidelines that we had forced us to conform. So unlike a jury, we were told in advance, here's your end result, now work backwards. If 9/11 didn't work that way, I mean, the whatever amounts that you know, Feinberg came up with, whether it would have been $1 billion or $2 billion, whatever it is, there was no budget. We had a budget, and we, of course, were mindful that that was our marching order. So bottom line, the hearings were extremely important, and we just followed Minnesota law and did what we thought a jury would do.
We heard testimony from Ken Feinberg early in the process about his experience with the 9/11 fund, and he was actually advising people on the Virginia Tech shooting special fund setup as well. You know, I've said before, and I still think it's true, that the 9/11 fund was at least in part established for purposes of an international diplomatic message, as well as a scheme to compensate those who were injured. There were perhaps more tenuous claims that, you know, regarding potential liability by the United States government for their losses, but Congress gave him an open checkbook, essentially. We didn't have that luxury. We're still in a difficult budget situation. But the government as a deep pocket is always a concern in that regard. So that was one motivation among many for having a budget, even if it was uncapped in comparison to what the statutory tort claim limit was. At the time, it was $300,000 per individual and $1 million aggregate for the overall incident. And we removed the aggregate cap altogether as a matter of policy for that purpose, and we raised the individual cap to $400,000, which was scheduled by pre-existing law to go up to $400,000 on January 1 anyway.
You know, I think there was another difference related from the process here in Minnesota compared to the 9/11 Commission that allowed survivors to feel better in Minnesota about the process. To participate in the 9/11 Commission compensation process, people had to opt in. They had to agree to waive all their rights without knowing what the process would be or the possible outcome to them. You did not require that in Minnesota. Survivors could participate in our process and not know what the outcome is and decide at the end, when they knew the outcome, whether they wanted to accept or reject the offer. And I believe that once the survivors went through the process, had a chance to meet with the panel, hear what we were interested in and concerned about, and ask them questions and explain our process to them, I just really feel that survivors walked away with a greater satisfaction of being involved and knowing that it was their decision in the end whether to accept the settlement.
One other difference was that they had, in the 9/11 fund, those claimants had to also waive their rights to sue any private parties in connection with it. So another main purpose of that fund was to protect the airline industry from massive lawsuits relating to their security measures or whatever might have been involved as well. So in Minnesota's case, the claimant still, they didn't have to waive any rights against any other potential third-party defendants relating to this bridge collapse. They had to waive the rights as to government agencies that might have been involved.
Senator, if I may, one last comment.
Yes, please, Mr.
Kirsch. On the timing, the way the statute was set up, our decision was final, and there was no appeal. Now, they could not accept the offer, but there really wasn't anywhere else they could go within the system. I think that finality and getting the checks to these people within 2 years, less than 2 years, in hindsight, is quite an accomplishment, because if you took 179 cases of accidents on August 1st, just random accidents, and you started the court system, not a large percentage of those cases would be complete at the time that these people got their checks. Now, in if you compare apples and apples, some of these people may not have been ready to settle if it was a regular case because some of the people were still being operated on. You know, they were having surgeries a year and a half later. And so some of the doctors had to stretch a little bit when asked for an opinion. Well, I wish I had more time, like 2 years after the accident, before I can give an opinion. And the lawyers would say, we don't have that luxury. So with those exceptions, it's really remarkable that 179 people got in and out of this system and got their money in less than 2 years.
So in a sense, they sort of traded the more final determination of their total damages by waiting longer. They traded that off against a more certainty and earlier compensation in this case. Would that be fair?
I think that's fair.
Would you recommend that in terms of if we ever have to do something like this again? Hopefully we will never have to, but if we do, having that same kind of dynamic at play?
In hindsight, now knowing what we know now, I would make very few changes in the process. I think I would have we would have worked closer with the Attorney General in advance to iron out the waiver language and some of that because we weren't sure what we were dealing with. But the mechanism that you folks set up in the statute, there's not a lot of tweaking to do. It worked amazingly well.
Well, as you think about that question, as it might apply to the broader scheme of it, and Mr. Tewksbury as well, if you have some thoughts on that, even minor tweaking that you think might be helpful for us to know, either now or if you get a chance later to submit to us, we'll just make it a part of the record. So if we ever have to come back to use this as a template for anything, we'll have some ideas on how to what to keep and maybe what to change.
As Susan indicated, when we got to the end of our initial process, we had spent more money than you gave us to spend, and so the process of how to get that back within the appropriation unfolded. The initial reduction from the $99 million was relatively easy because we took out all of the damages which were part of the claim but which had been compensated by insurers. We worked with the Attorney General's office to obtain waivers of the subrogation from the various insurers, which they had to do under the statute. The statute also provided that if they didn't waive, then the claimant had to provide them with 40 days notice so that they could object to the statute and whether it was constitutional in that regard. Ultimately, every one of them who had a potential subrogation claim did, in fact, sign a waiver.
Mr. Tewksbury, what was the total deduction then for the collateral sources that were already paid?
I think it's about $30 million in rough numbers, but that's more of a guess. I don't have that right here in front of us. The second area that we looked at then was kind of an interesting quirk under Minnesota law. We have a provision in the law and the way it's been interpreted by the courts that a tortfeasor is responsible for the damage which they cause. So if we have $100,000 worth of medical bills, for instance, and a health insurer steps forward and pays them and pays $70,000 pursuant to their contract and the agreements with the doctors, the claimant is yet able to go forward and collect that additional $30,000. The defendant is not freed of that. In this situation, though, because we had to reduce it, that seemed to be a place that we could take money that really didn't affect the plaintiff, and it didn't affect the doctor, and it didn't affect the insurance company. So that was our next level of reduction then from the amount. We then had to get into a little bit of statutory interpretation as to, as Susan indicated, we got down to the point where we're still $9 million. Let me back up a minute. The next big area of reduction was for the damages that would have qualified for the second fund, the supplemental fund, but were not within the definition. So the pain and suffering, the loss of aid, comfort, guidance, assistance, and companionship damages. Because remember, the second fund compensated for wage loss and medical bills, and prioritized that, indicating that medical bills had to be paid first. So when we went through that calculation, that reduced the balance until we got down to that $9.5 million that we were over. So we started brainstorming, and I think ultimately went through a process similar to what you do on your taxation issues here. One idea was, okay, we have 179 claims, and we're $9 million short. Let's divide it out. When that's $50,000 a claim in rough terms. But some of the claims didn't merit payment of $50,000, and that kind of reduction then would have left some of the claimants with no money. And, in fact, if they had a $30,000 claim, wouldn't have generated the amount we needed. So we went through and we used, as you do, a combination of kind of a flat percentage reduction basis and then a graduated reduction basis depending on categories. So that what we ultimately did after we got the 12.6, got reduced to the 12.6, what we did was we took the $400,000 individuals who qualified for the second fund and we reduced that by 10%. The statute was worded in such a manner that said if the claim, if your claim exceeds the $400,000, you qualify for the second fund. It didn't indicate that you had to receive the $400,000.
Thank you, Mr. Tewksbury. I'm going to interrupt you for just a moment. We actually have a quorum on both sides. So while we do have that quorum here, I'd like to ask, we'll go back to the agenda item number 2, approval of meetings, minutes of the meeting from April 14th, and ask members to take a quick look at it. See if there are any suggested changes and see if there's a motion to approve them.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
I'd like to move approval of minutes.
Is there any discussion on the motion? Any suggested changes? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Minutes are approved. All right. Thank you. Now we'll revert to the presentation.
Back to the numbers, sorry. What left us then as we went through, we had listed the claimants by their awards from high to low. And then so what we did was we went through there, having made a generalized reduction to everybody and put them in categories. So the under $20,000, the 20 to 40, 40 to 60, 60 to 75, that type of approach. And then made a reduction in each of those categories. The process that we went through, we ended up reducing the amount that we needed so that we were back to the $24 million. But we kept every individual in the same order they were in relation to everybody else. So that even though everybody's claim was not reduced by the same percentage or the same dollar amount, they remained in line with everybody else as a method of in our minds anyways, of assuring a fairness of the award, not only to what we could do with the legislation, but vis-a-vis the other claimants as well. That process, I think, worked fairly well, and we were able to get down to the numbers that we had. The second major aspect of what we had to deal with is you gave us a second task, not only of determining the value and how to apportion it, but asked us to create a new release document, which heretofore had not existed in Minnesota, with the approval of the Attorney General's office. And so we did that, and it's been labeled a Perringer Plus release, in which it has aspects of the Perringer type of release, which allows a claimant to settle their claim with one defendant and settle that percentage here with the state. And then continue their actions against other parties who they believe to be at fault. What the plus aspect of it is because you had the subrogation language in there to pay the state back, we had to take that concept and remodel it so that we had to come up with the two numbers. So each person got a number that says, here's what we think the total value of your claim is, here's what your offer, and in some cases, a third number, here's what it is from the second fund as well. That first number, your total value, is now the trigger as they go forward in their claims against other potential defendants. If they receive a compensation of that amount or higher, then the state will be repaid the money that they were appropriated and we paid out in this process. So that's a little bit different. Time will tell how the courts receive that and interpret it, but we think we accomplished what your intent was in that regard, and it will clearly be the way this fund works. It'll be interesting to see if that now broadens to other tort claims in Minnesota as well.
How would you anticipate seeing, there's going to be third-party cross-claims going on all over the place here. How would you anticipate seeing that play out where, say, let's take, for example, I'm not saying anything about potential final liability, but if the contractor on the bridge, who in some cases has been accused of having too much load on the bridge for what the bridge could handle, and they get sued by a claimant who's already settled with the state, and that contractor then brings in the state as a third-party defendant saying, the state was supposed to have calculated the appropriate load on the bridge and tell us what it was, and they either miscalculated or they didn't tell us. So really, it's not our fault. We were doing what we thought we were allowed to do by the state. The state's responsible for that portion of it. How do you envision seeing that playing out for the individual claimants?
The release has extinguished the state's responsibility in that regard. Ultimately, the scenario you give goes before a fact finder if it's not resolved by way of settlement, and they will determine, a jury would determine percentages of responsibility for each party in the action, whether it be the contractor, inspectors, or engineering companies, or the state, or what have you, on a percentage basis. The money the people have taken and the signature of the release has released the percentage of fault that the state might ultimately be responsible for. That has been settled, and that's the way the Perringer release works. What has not been resolved is if they go forward and the jury determines that the value of their case is greater than what we had awarded, for instance, and they collect it from other defendants, now they would have more money, they would have collected more money than what we had said the value of the case was, and that triggers repayment to the state then of that amount. Now, if it settles somewhere short of that, which most pieces of major litigation like this do, there'll be a negotiation that goes of all the involved parties in terms of who gets what and how that gets divvied up and whether the state will get any money back or whether they're giving that up. And that'll all be subject to another negotiation down the road. But the state will probably, I would anticipate, as a defendant in these actions or as a third-party defendant, probably will be dismissed from all of the lawsuit by reason of the release document that each of the claimants has signed. They may be a party to litigation for people who have claims that were not victims as defined by the statute. So, for instance, the bridge fell on some train cars. If the railroad has a claim and wants to bring it against the state would be a defendant in that action, because they weren't a claimant in this action.
So you were saying that if Plaintiff A brings a claim in court against Defendant B and Defendant B tries to bring in the state as a co-defendant, that the state would be dismissed out even as a co-defendant in that case?
Yes.
Because of the Perringer Plus release?
Right. That's the goal. That was the purpose of it. Like I say, subject to how courts interpret it. And the state may very well be a party in some of this litigation, more on the plaintiff's side of the equation as they attempt to get money back from these various other defendants as well. And through various contractual relationships they would have had with the companies they did business with in terms of indemnity provisions or additional insured provisions and things like that.
So the plaintiff could Plaintiff A could bind Defendant B from bringing a claim against the state as a co-defendant? By their release?
What's happened is the state has settled its percentage of fault. So it's not that the B is prevented from doing that. That's already been taken. It's already been compensated. Okay. So maybe the award may be higher than what the state should have paid to a particular person on the percentage. It may be less. That's the risk you take with a Perringer release by doing a percentage settlement. But it's taken out that claim.
Okay, so what... You may not want to answer this question, but as I understand, the contractor and the bridge initiated a lawsuit as a plaintiff against the state. How would these releases affect that kind of a case?
To the extent that their claim is for contribution for what they ultimately have to pay to these individual claimants, this release will extinguish that. And I expect the Attorney General will obtain court orders dismissing them from those pieces of litigation. To the extent that it is for people who were or businesses who weren't part of the victim relief fund, those claims still exist and still go forward.
Anyone else have any other questions on that topic or anything? Anything else?
Just a concluding comment, I guess. We are very pleased that everyone who submitted a claim in this process accepted their settlement offer and have released all the claims against the state and the other released parties identified in the releases. And to that extent, I guess you must say that the process was a success. We're very honored to participate as members of the panel in this process. I think the bill that was ultimately passed as a result of your efforts was very visionary and gave us a great outline in order for us to get the accomplish the task at hand.
So I guess I did have another question or two. And by any means, Mr. Watson, if you want to jump in, as someone who's had a lot of legal experience as Chief Counsel of the Senate, you were instrumental in helping to formulate a lot of what was going on here, along with Kathy Pontius from your office, who worked very closely with the whole process. But so let's say for someone who the more seriously injured, the ones who qualified for the supplemental fund, is it possible then that, say, the first $400,000 that they got out of the first fund would have basically been in compensation for pain and suffering only, and that medical expenses then would have been paid out of the supplemental fund to the extent they weren't already offset by other sources?
That's a possible outcome. I can't say with respect to a particular claim, you know, which of those that actually happened in, but that's a possible outcome. I mean, we found total damages of several million dollars in individual personal injury claims or individual wrongful death claims, but the greatest, you know, the highest offer to any one individual was $2.2 million. And probably the highest, you know, total damages would have exceeded $8 million. So there were a number of claims where, by operation of the cap and the limited appropriation, people didn't come close to getting half of their damages, but it certainly they received a lot more compensation than they would have had the per occurrence limit of $1 million stayed in place and the old tort cap laws that otherwise would apply had you not acted to create the special compensation process applied.
We took a couple of steps here that ordinarily would not have been taken. Ordinarily a defendant, other than the state, not subject to a liability cap, would have had obligations, or the plaintiff recovering from a defendant would have had to pay back the medical insurer the property damage, and so on, once liability is assigned, because those insurers would have gotten, they would have had subrogation rights.
That's true, and they still maintain those rights in the additional claim process. For example, the four cases that are now pending in the courts, any plan that waived their subrogation interest in the special compensation process waived their claim related to the state in any municipality, but they may choose to pursue that in subsequent litigation.
How much part of the detail that you had to go through in some of the interpretations, I guess, speaks in part to the wisdom of this body and not trying to forecast every detail that would need to be resolved. And so we appreciate that you had to kind of sort some of that out yourself and create a new document even to work through that. But are there any other lessons, any other thoughts that you might have in terms of tweaking of the statute or approaches? I mean, we were in a position of having to try to take extraordinary steps both to get some rather prompt compensation for the survivors yet also protect the taxpayer dollars, which were exposed significantly, and protect against some potential lawsuits, constitutional litigation over the applicability of the caps as well. And so do you have any suggestions, having taken those steps in return for basically providing relief from the aggregate cap and allowing a larger compensation scheme to go forward. In terms of the overall structure, or some of those are public policy decisions, not legal questions. But even in terms of legal questions, how we might have done it differently, in your experience?
You know, we really have remarked to one another at how there's very little that we would change with this bill. We think that the law that was passed was a very good roadmap for us, and it did strike a balance between some tough policy questions. But questions that we think, you know, that were answered admirably. You wanted to balance the timing. You wanted to get prompt compensation to survivors, but yet give people an adequate opportunity for their injuries to have been treated and matured enough so that the future was predictable, so that we could make as accurate decisions as we could about their total damages in the future. And so striking that balance, getting it done within less than 2 years, it put a rush on some of the claims, but overall it promoted prompt compensation to the survivors. I'm sure from the survivors' perspective, they think, geez, a year and a half to get payment is a long time. But we all know, in the three of us spend our lives working in litigation and various types of personal injury claims, and we know that a year and a half is a very quick time frame to get a final resolution in a personal injury or wrongful death claim. So the balance was struck fairly, I think. You just can't solve every problem in one piece of legislation. It did for the balance. On balance, it worked great. It would have been a lot easier for us to have an unlimited pot of money, but you have to be responsible with the taxpayers' money. And limiting the appropriation, I think it was clear from the overall bill that you really wanted to get at the human suffering that was caused by this bridge collapse and not pay all damages, but help compensate and ease the burden of the survivors who suffered the greatest losses. So you left an individual cap in place, but yet allowed a safety valve with the supplemental payments for those people who had lost significantly, economic losses, loss of earnings, loss of their ability to work, had significant ongoing medical care and future medical bills that would be uncompensated otherwise. That, you know, to me strikes an appropriate balance between respecting the tort caps that are in place under our law and yet providing a safety valve that allows individuals injured in a mass catastrophe like this to gain some compensation to help ease their burdens as they go through life.
There's two options facing that you folks is representing our citizenry. You go through the tort system or you have special legislation. And if 179 people went through the tort system, they would all be dividing up $1 million. And it would have been more than 179 without a tort system, because the definition that you gave of a victim limited claims. You know, people, the ownership of cars, the box cars underneath, the people that were nearby that observed the bridge going down and developed psychological issues because of that, there would have been more than 179 claims. And $1 million wouldn't have gone very far. So by doing it the way you did, I think you sort of eliminated a call for, well, the cap's really not fair and all those kinds of issues, because the bill was fair and the people were treated fairly. And I think that calmed things down. And like Sue said, the benefit of getting the fast payment, it just can't be underestimated. If you didn't have this bill, I doubt anybody would have been paid any money yet, and it would be far more than 179 people, and the court systems would be far more clogged because of this. So it did serve a public benefit.
Then I suppose you would have had all of the other potential defendants bringing claims against the state, and the courts would have had to sort that piece of it out as well as the individual claims.
And the workers' comp. So the workers' comp carriers would be suing you, you know, all the medical people, all those claims that we discounted because of the statute would be viable.
Give us an idea how many hours each of you spent on this. I know you all have busy private practices of your own. And
I actually kept time records. And because I'm a defense lawyer, you know, and it just comes by habit, I would say we each probably spent 1,000 hours. Maybe more.
And as I recall, there was some money set aside for administration, I think $750,000, and I don't recall in the legislation if there was an expectation, or I don't think a dollar amount was assigned for compensation of the panel members, or if there was any even amount anticipated. Did the Supreme Court give any compensation to the panel members for your time?
They did. We operated on a flat rate contract in which we agreed to perform the service and provide the staffing level necessary to get the job done. So our law firms provided staff and our time, and they were done on flat rate contracts, and there were some additional expenses incurred by the panel in order to accomplish this process. For example, the website, there's a charge to create a website, there's a charge to reserve names and a monthly fee to maintain it and keep it operating. And as it turns out, we got the best deal from the Minnesota State Bar Association, and they have some very tech-savvy people on staff that volunteered a lot of time. They got a very small stipend for their help on the panel in designing this website and did a fantastic job. They activated all of our forms and checked every link on the website and made certain that we launched on July 28th ahead of time and have maintained the site ever since. If we needed an update posted, a new deadline posted, a new form of some kind, they've been very helpful. But that was another contract that came out of the administrative appropriation. There was an email account that went along with that website. So that, right. And then we are all in three different offices, but we needed to function as if we were one. Technology allows us to do that, and one piece of technology that that came out of that administrative appropriation was a cell phone that was the office of the special masters. And it was a phone that we just shared. Every few weeks it would go from my office to Steve's office to Mike's office, and we'd just take turns answering the phone. And that cell phone, when once the hearing process began and we no longer needed the cell phone because people were used to calling the office, our individual offices where they were assigned for hearing, then we canceled the cell phone to save the expenses. But those are the types of administrative costs that came out of that appropriation.
Any other questions or comments? Mr. Watson, do you have any questions?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to join you in thanking the panel for taking the words on a piece of paper that the legislature put together and making them live and really do everything that the legislature had hoped would happen as a result of passing that law. Thank you.
Well, the people of Minnesota, Representative Osmond, did you have a question? Or
I was just going to make a comment. To
go ahead.
Your time.
No, go ahead.
I just wanted to also commend the work of this precedent-setting special masters panel for just doing a terrific job. I think that it's a job well done. And I know that as a citizen of the state of Minnesota, I really appreciate your work and what it's done for those that were injured in this process, as well as for the taxpayers, and what your work has really helped resolve some very difficult situations. I'd also like to thank Senator Lance for this, for your work on the legislation, the compassion, the vision, the creativity that you put into this. I think was just fantastic, and I like to echo as many of the comments of the panelists as they've commented on the legislation, and I think that the authors of that legislation did a terrific job.
Thank you. I will also comment that the Chief Justice chose well.
Thank you.
We have before us three of the top practitioners in this field in the state of Minnesota. And for you to take the time out of your practices to do this as a public service, and you certainly could have been off practicing your usual practices and made far much more money than you did doing this, and that's the case for everyone who serves in the legislature, frankly. So we understand, you know, what this is like. Most of us come from other jobs, too. Some of us maintain those other jobs during session, but for you to take the time and the commitment and the passion that you brought to the position and your expertise, which we all relied upon to make this process work, to the extent that I can say it on behalf of the people of Minnesota, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So, if there are no other comments, we'll conclude the hearing. We're adjourned.
You have an extra
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
That's a wonderful thing to hear. They'll come up with some later projects.
No doubt. No doubt.
Not as much as it used to be. I know.